This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Reinhold Niebuhr is credited with the Serenity Prayer, but a documentary shown on some PBS stations details his influence on theology, politics, and society at large. An American Conscience, the Reinhold Niebuhr Story, will be screened as part of Kalamazoo College's annual Thompson Lecture on Thursday, May 4th. It begins at 7 o'clock in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Building. Jeremy Sabella was a visiting professor at Kay College last fall. He served as a consultant on the documentary and also wrote the companion book. Sabella and former Kalamazoo College professor Gary Dorian will lead a discussion on Reinhold Niebuhr after the showing of the documentary. Jeremy Sabella, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What got you interested in Reinhold Niebuhr just as an object of study, if we want to use that term?
Well, to be really broad about it, his rhetoric is really good. The first book I read by Niebuhr was actually in my doctoral program. I was already invested in another track. I thought I was going to do ancient Christianity. I picked up Niebuhr in my final semester of coursework for the first time. I read Moral Man and Immoral Society, and I was blown away. He's a really good writer, a really good rhetorician. He knows how to evoke emotions with words, and he's committed to talking about really basic problems in American life. In Moral Man and Immoral Society, he's talking about what do you need to do to actually affect large-scale social change? What does that require? What is it about human nature that makes us so resistant to those changes? And how do we bring about those changes given that people are stubborn and stuck in their ways and irrational in a lot of ways? And so it was both the strength of his rhetoric and the scope of his vision and his willingness to call a spade a spade. He's very, very blunt in the way that he talks about things, but I found that refreshing.
There's a point in this documentary where Niebuhr is mentioned in a pretty long list of religious leaders around that time, Norman Vincent Peale, Billy Graham, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Joshua Heschel, Paul Tillich. When you look at that list, how do you see Reinhold Niebuhr fitting in? And do you think that there is something that makes him stand out in that list that makes him a little different?
Well, he hits his stride a little bit earlier than the other figures that you mentioned. And so he influences a lot of what they end up doing, even if in these rather indirect ways. You see the clearest line of influence with somebody like Martin Luther King. In the documentary, we talk about King picking up Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society when he was a grad student. And at first pass, Martin Luther King found Niebuhr too pessimistic. But once King was in the teeth of the civil rights struggle, he revisited Niebuhr and said, actually, this wasn't pessimism. He was just being realistic about what social change requires. So a lot of the dynamics around how do you make nonviolent resistance effective? How do you go about your marches in such a way that you actually force people to confront these deep injustices and prick their consciences and induce change? King draws on Niebuhr for a lot of insights for how to do that. And to be clear, you know, King's one of our great theologians in his own right. His theological project is different from Niebuhr's, but when it comes to inducing social change, that is a place where you see a rather direct line of influence. With Abraham Joshua Heschel, Reinhold Niebuhr actually reviewed Heschel's first book, gave rave reviews for it. Niebuhr was the first major American figure to notice Heschel and realize, okay, we have one of our great minds here. You know, Rabbi Heschel ended up becoming quite prominent in his own right and quite an influential figure also in the civil rights movement. And I think it is an open question. If Niebuhr hadn't picked up Heschel and written this glowing review of his work, Heschel's career might not have launched. I think that's a very real possibility. Obviously, when you're talking about figures like Norman Vincent Peale and Billy Graham, Niebuhr's take on Christianity is quite different. For them, for somebody like Norman Vincent Peale, Your Best Life Now. Peale's concerned with helping people use faith almost as in this therapeutic vein, as something that they can use to get ahead in life, to get ahead in their business, to be positive thinkers. Niebuhr's impulses are almost the opposite, right? For him, faith is a resource to delve into what's wrong. It's what steals us to face the depths of how much we screw up as human beings and still hold on to hope in the midst of that. So his impulses are different from somebody like Peale's in that regard. And as far as Billy Graham is concerned, Niebuhr actually wrote a good deal on Graham, mostly in a critical vein. But he also wanted Graham to succeed. He realized that Graham had a big platform, and he wanted Graham to use that platform well. He wanted Graham to use that platform to talk about social change. He thought Graham was too focused on the individual and individual conversions. And it's not that Niebuhr didn't think that mattered. He just didn't think that was enough. You needed to talk about social change and social sin. And I don't think Graham really picked that up in a full-throated way. His focus was always on the individual. But later in life, in the 1980s, Graham basically says, I need more Niebuhrs in my life. Give me more Reinhold Niebuhr. And he also went on to comment, Niebuhr helped me work through some of my problems. So for Graham, trying to figure out how to negotiate his own relationship to power, Niebuhr was a resource for helping him do that.
At one point, the commentator and author David Brooks, quite familiar to NPR listeners who regularly weighs in on the events of the day, but he mentions in this documentary that liberals can find things that they like in Reinhold Niebuhr, but there also are things that conservatives latch onto. Is it the case that Reinhold Niebuhr is just so prolific a writer and perhaps such a broad thinker that he wrote something that almost anybody can find and say, ah, that applies to me, or that applies to the way I think?
Well, as David Brooks put it, everybody found something they liked in Niebuhr. And that's one of his great virtues, and it's also what makes him a little bit tricky. Niebuhr wrote voluminously. He published over 2,500 articles. I cannot tell you how many times I have checked that fact, because it's mind-blowing to me. 2,500 articles. So he's writing constantly. And he's commenting on everything under the sun. And yes, he's doing so from a particular theological vantage point. But when your commentary is so broad on so many different issues, other people who are interested in that sort of theologically informed commentary are going to find something in that they like and they can use. So on the one hand, I think he's unique as a bridge builder in our particular context. It's not just building bridges between religious discourse and political discourse, let's say. It's also building bridges between liberal and conservative. He's one of the only figures in our moment that liberals and conservatives still want to claim as one of their own. And that's a valuable thing. But I think we also need to confront the fact that we all have our own versions of Niebuhr. You know, Niebuhr can sort of be co-opted and weaponized for anyone's discourse. And that is something we have to be aware of in interacting with this thought.
And is that in part because as he goes through life, Reinhold Niebuhr at times goes back and revisits things which he has said and comes to different conclusions, or maybe changes his view on things a bit and says that, you know, maybe what I thought previously doesn't really apply now, or maybe I need to take a fresh look at this particular issue?
So the magazine, The Christian Century, had a feature once upon a time called How My Mind Has Changed. Niebuhr wrote for that feature three times. The way that Gary Dorian put it, Reinhold Niebuhr changed his mind every 10 years. And there is something to that. He's very responsive to politics as they're developing. So a lot of his commentary is on current events. What Niebuhr sees as the major problems confronting American society in 1928 Detroit, let's say, where he did a lot of his, he was a pastor in Detroit for many years, is very different from what he sees as the major issues confronting America in 1939 with World War II on the horizon, which is also different from what Niebuhr sees as the major issues when America's at the pinnacle of world power in the early 1950s. And so he is changing his approach a lot in light of facts on the ground. And that is part of this dynamic of people gravitating toward different parts of Niebuhr. You can tell a lot about a person's political leanings depending on which time period of Niebuhr they're interested in. for a lot of very good reasons, conservatives are attracted to Niebuhr talking to America at the pinnacle of world power, right? Talking about the pitfalls and the possibilities that come with wielding great power. Liberals and radicals tend to like the early Niebuhr, who's agitating for social change in the early 1930s. People of a more moderate streak tend to gravitate toward the Niebuhr of the World War II era, when he's trying to articulate a rationale for why we need democracy in a world where political options seem to be running out. So everybody can sort of pick and choose a little bit, and you can tell a lot about a person depending on which version of Niebuhr they gravitate toward.
How important is faith in the background of all of that? In other words, you know, if someone can reach different conclusions, does that mean that at the same time they are reexamining their faith? Or does it appear from his writings that he was reexamining his faith at times when maybe he reached some different conclusions about various issues?
Well, I think faith for Niebuhr is what gave him, in many ways, the confidence and courage to change his mind. He, in Niebuhr's understanding, he certainly believes in providence and believes that God is ultimately in control of history. But he's also very skeptical about the human ability to discern the workings of providence. And so he's holding those two things in tension. His assertion of providence gives him this theological framework out of which to analyze current events. His skepticism about the human ability to understand those workings are what caused him to pivot quite a bit and give him what I see as intellectual humility, right? The willingness to look at his early opinions and revise them over and over and over again because he doubts his own ability to understand the workings of providence. And so I think faith is crucial to Niebuhr's work. That doesn't mean that you have to agree with him on anything theologically to derive benefit from his analysis. There was actually a group in the 40s and 50s that called themselves Atheists for Niebuhr, right. That had no real interest in his theology, but they thought that the way he used the concept of something like original sin was really valuable. So you have these political commentators with no religious background talking about original sin.
And Gary Dorian says in the documentary that Niebuhr loved the idea that there was this group out there that called themselves Atheists for Niebuhr.
Oh yeah, no, he was a committed pluralist in that regard. For him, Christianity was not about insider baseball. It was not a discourse for other Christians. It helped him. Christianity in his hands is something that helps you articulate certain truths about the way the world works, period. And anybody who's in that world can come to those articulations and say, okay, this gets at something. Even if I don't buy the whole worldview, there's a snippet here that rings true for me, and I'm going to run with that. So Christianity, paradoxically, in the view of many, becomes a basis for a full-throated pluralism in Niebuhr. And I think he sees it as promising for discourse in a pluralist context and in a pluralist nation.
One particular point in the documentary where I think perhaps Niebuhr's changing view of the world, along with his humility, maybe sort of intersect is the idea that he ended up debating his brother at one point about world affairs. And this is a very interesting story that his daughter told about how these two men, obviously both deep thinkers, obviously both committed in various ways to theology and to public discourse. But when they were debating, Niebuhr's daughter says, well, her father acknowledged that maybe Reinhold Niebuhr in this case was overmatched, right?
You know, so H. Richard, Helmut Richard Niebuhr, Reinhold's younger brother, you know, was a dominant theologian in his own right. And in many ways, you know, Elizabeth Sifton, Reinhold's daughter, says in the documentary, my father thought that he was the finer thinker and the clearer writer. You know, true, I have the gift of gab, he would say.
Yeah.
But Helmut is the better theologian. And there's a lot to back that up. You know, so the debate that they had in 1930 was on the Japanese invasion of Manchuria and how the U.S. should respond. And Reinhold thought the U.S. should respond as assertively as they could with embargoes and things of that nature. And H. Richard thought that the U.S. should basically do nothing. In fact, his article was called The Grace of Doing Nothing. And he was advocating this position of, you know, step back, stop pretending that you know how to control world affairs, because we don't, and we just need to let things play out. And so the brothers debated this position, and that continued to be a flashpoint between them throughout their careers, but their correspondence was always appreciative. And I think H. Richard is really responsible for Reinhold Niebuhr becoming a really good theologian. It was after Moral Man and Immoral Society where H. Richard basically said to Reinhold in their private correspondence, listen, you're a great social critic. You're one of the best. There's no doubt about that. But you need to shore up your theological foundations. Right? You need to revisit your Pauline scriptures in the Bible. You need to revisit your Augustine. You need to really delve into this concept of original sin and explore what that means for your particular brand of social criticism. And Reinhold took those critiques to heart and in the process became a really good theologian in his own right. And that has everything to do, in my view, with H. Richard.
So World War II and the run-up to it maybe put Reinhold Niebuhr in a little different position in terms of being more supportive of the idea of U.S. military action. But he did seem to do another turn again at Vietnam.
He did do another turn in Vietnam because for Reinhold, context was everything. In the context of World War II, we're remarkable in our capacity for revisionist history, right? And we forget how isolationist a country we were in 1937, 1938, 1939. Reinhold is one of the first people that really pushed for intervention. There are a couple of factors that play into that. He's the son of German immigrants. He's German-American. This makes him very sensitive to the anti-Semitic rhetoric emanating from Nazi Germany. So he's speaking out on behalf of the Jewish community as early as the early 1930s. This is long before anyone else, at least in the American scene, is really doing this. So he has this awareness of the Nazi threat and what that means, has a familiarity with the culture in which this is unfolding, and starts arguing from very early on, listen, we are part of this conflict whether we want to be or not. It's going to find us inevitably whether we want to be involved or not. And so we need to head that off at the pass and get involved now while our involvement can still do some good. So he's pushing for intervention with World War II, but once we turn to Vietnam, he just does not see the same sorts of factors at work. He doesn't think we have any compelling reasons to be there. And he sees a lot of really problematic machinations behind the scenes that ended up resulting in us getting embedded in that conflict. And so it may be that early on he's a little bit more ambivalent in his rhetoric, but as the conflict unfolded, he spoke out very critically about Vietnam and didn't think we had any business there. And frankly, I think he did so on the same sort of very realistic grounds, right? The context of World War II was vastly different from the context of Vietnam. So I think he remains internally consistent, even if his conclusions about military involvement appear completely different.
At times in the documentary, when you hear him talking, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, it was time in Detroit, for instance, he sounds like a man ahead of his time on the issue of race. And then, but we come to a point later in this documentary where Martin Luther King Jr. says, why don't you join me and he declines. So how do you balance all that out on the issue of race and where Reinhold Niebuhr ended up?
Yeah, the question of race in Niebuhr is a complicated one. And I think it comes down to the fact that Niebuhr was at his best when he was involved with issues firsthand. He's great on race after he's been in Detroit for 13 years during the Ford boom years. He chairs an interracial committee during that time. He interacts directly with leaders of the Black community. He takes on the Ku Klux Klan. And in the process, because he had that personal contact, develops this really nuanced sense of what was going on and how to respond to it. And so the conclusions that he draws in the early 1930s were well ahead of their time. He is very full-throated in his advocacy for the Black community and their struggle for justice. By the early 1950s, he has a stroke in 1952 that sidelines him. He has to cut back a lot in his physical activity. He can't see the civil rights movement unfolding firsthand. He's not going to their meetings. He's not in church basements. And I think, you know, from his Riverside apartment, he's not able to appreciate how much the civil rights movement means. You know, he's concerned at that point with stability. He just got out of the World War II this incredibly unstable era, and he's looking at the unfolding civil rights movement and is concerned that this is pushing too hard, too fast. And I think he's rightly criticized for taking that position, because there isn't very much of anything ethical in terms of those considerations. Stability on its own, yes, it's a good thing, but we also have other ethical considerations that we need to think about. And so Reinhold goes for stability at that point, ends up articulating this conservative position on race, declines to sign this document pushing Eisenhower to take action in the mid-1950s. But then he, interestingly enough, hits his stride again in the mid-1960s. So at this point, he's even older. His health is in even worse shape, but he's developed these relationships with people like Heschel, who was very involved in the movement. He ended up doing an interview with James Baldwin. And so the contact with figures like Heschel and Baldwin, I think, reinvigorated his thinking on race once again, because he was able to have this personal contact with figures who are directly involved.
I mentioned at the beginning that one of the things Reinhold Niebuhr is known for, and perhaps if you're looking for the single sentence of what he is, the man credited with the Serenity Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too short shrift of what he did? I mean, is that just too simplistic that, you know, that this is the thing we recognize him for? Because if we're going to pick something out of all his other writings, it's hard to say that this is the piece that stands out. Is that why maybe the Serenity Prayer gets mentioned first?
Well, what I see the Serenity Prayer as is an indication of how much Niebuhr's influence has seeped into American culture without us even knowing it. The Serenity Prayer is one of the few prayers that even non-religious people know and are familiar with. And, you know, this is striking to me just a few weeks ago, kind of in a similar vein of how deeply Niebuhr's permeated. We find this story about James Comey, the FBI director, having a secret Twitter account with under the alias of Reinhold Niebuhr, right? And, you know, this comes on the heels of Obama in 2007 when he's running for office, mentioning to David Brooks that Niebuhr was his favorite political philosopher. So it gives you a sense of the scope of that influence, right? People of power, in power and entrusted with the responsibilities that come with that, know who Niebuhr is. People whose lives are falling apart, who are struggling to hold it together, are using the Serenity Prayer, his words, to help them do that, even if they don't know who the author of those words were. It is a rather simplistic way of getting at Niebuhr. But I also think you can make the case that his work as a whole is really just unfolding the content of that prayer, right? He's looking, you know, how do you balance serenity and courage when confronting catastrophe on a global level? You know, when do you run up against limits of things you can't change? When do you need the courage to change things that need to be changed, even though it's really hard? Niebuhr's thought is trying to help us navigate the complexities of that. So the prayer distills, I think, in this helpful way, what Niebuhr's work as a whole is trying to do.
And does it also reflect, as we've talked about, those changes in opinion which he wrote about, his own struggle with that very thing? You know, what can I change? What can I not change? How much energy to put into the things that I think should be changed?
Yeah, you know, Niebuhr wrestled with that his whole life. And that wrestling is obvious in his writings. And this is something that I appreciate about him as an academic. It's easy to try to mask the personal reasons why we write about what we write, why we're interested in the topics that we're interested in, why we come to the conclusions that we come to. And for Niebuhr, it's all out there all the time. You know, he's telling you quite clearly, these are the things that keep me up at night. These are the things that give me anxiety. And here are the resources that help me cope with that and help me figure out how to wake up in the morning and keep going. And for Niebuhr, it came down to faith, right? His faith sustained him. His faith helped him to confront the worst on a daily basis, to just stare at the worst in human nature and still hold on to hope in the midst of that. And as somebody who studies his thought, I find that very reassuring in my own work. Right, that we can be engaged at this deep emotional and spiritual level with what we do, even if what we're doing is mostly intellectual.
Do you find that his influence continues to grow? Are there still young people out there who maybe are currently in school someplace who still find Reinhold Niebuhr, they read it, and they have a reaction like you have had or like people have had now for decades?
I think his influence has persisted. I'm convinced by the argument that it's never really gone away. It's had ebbs and flows. There's no question about that. But there's always been a sector of American society that has realized, okay, this is a really important thinker. He gets at both the greatness and the misery of the American experiment in a way that's useful for all of us and continues to be. And in terms of college students reading him today, the pattern that some of my colleagues have recognized, at least at the undergraduate level, is their first contact with Niebuhr, they might not like him very much. You know, they'll react a lot of times in a similar vein as Martin Luther King reacted at first. This guy's too pessimistic. But then as they get deeper into their studies and delve into the complexities of all these issues around race and class in our country, they come back to Niebuhr and they find somebody that helps them think through those things and end up becoming fans of his thought in the process. And I also think that there are always those who are already involved in activism, whose daily lives acquaint them with everything that's wrong with the American experiment. And for them, I think Niebuhr's a much easier sell. I think they come to him almost immediately and say, okay, this is somebody that's grappling with these questions. He's not right on all of it. In fact, he gets some things quite wrong, but there's this gut level honesty to the way that he wrestles with these things that resonates today, I think, with millennials in this sort of search for authenticity. Niebuhr's an authentic thinker, and they pick that up almost immediately.
Are the ones who read his book and are instantly hooked the ones then who write books about him, perhaps help make a documentary and write a companion book to go along with it?
Well, you know, in a certain respect, yeah. But I don't think those that are hooked by it necessarily go the academic route. That happened to me, the route that I took with it. But I think for other people, it takes them the activist route. You know, it gives them a framework to make sense of their activism and to keep going when it doesn't feel like things are ever going to change. You know, I think Niebuhr becomes a resource that helps them continue to be engaged in that struggle to try to be a force of good in the world.
Jeremy Sabella, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Jeremy Sabella served as a consultant on the documentary An American Conscience, The Reinhold Niebuhr Story, that will be screened as part of Kalamazoo College's annual Thompson Lecture on Thursday, May 4th. It begins at 7 o'clock in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Building. Sabella is also the author of the companion book with that documentary. You can find links with more information at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.